my voice. I have my fourth cold of the session, which is unusual for me. But let us go forward. We'll begin taking public testimony at the Subcommittee on House Bill 3522, and I'd invite Dave Cook and whoever else he'd like to bring with him. I understand you have a budget hearing somewhere else.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Dave Cook, Director of the Department of Corrections. I'm here to testify in favor of the A3s on 3522. The DOC does not have a long and large history with this kind of behavior with our employees, volunteers, or contractors, but there has been significant attention paid to this issue in the last several months by Amnesty International and other groups. We believe it's important to set a standard that is professional and above reproach, and I think this bill probably establishes a standard that is generally tolerable to most of the people in the Department of Corrections, and I think even for those that it's intolerable for, they need to get on board with a standard that essentially eliminates any opportunity for the sexual exploitation of female offenders by any employees, volunteers, or contractors that do business with the Department of Corrections.
And your comments relate to the Dash A3 amendment?
Mr. Chair, these comments relate to 3522A3.
Thank you. Any questions from Mr. Cook concerning House Bill 3522 regarding the Dash A3 amendment?
3522.
It has to do with custodial sexual misconduct, A3, and basically the sexual relationship between corrections officers.
Oh, that's what helps.
Or a volunteer?
Mr. Chair, I think it is important to recognize that it is volunteers or those contractors doing business with the Department of Corrections or DOC employees.
Yeah, are there any questions?
No.
All right. Do you want to testify on HJR 82?
Dr. Ben DeHaan's going to do that, okay. I think, for us in just a bit.
Good. I wanted to accommodate you.
Thanks very much.
To talk about that. All right. Thank you. Next, I would invite Dennis Palmieri and Mary Boxton. Oh. That's right. Oh, we got to be ready for that today. Go ahead and call. I think they have
to.
Why don't you, Dennis, identify yourself and please begin.
Certainly. Good afternoon. Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dennis Palmieri. I am the West Coast staff representative for Amnesty International USA. And it's a privilege to have the opportunity to speak before you briefly today on this important issue. I am here today to express my organization's support for House Bill 3522, the -A3 version of that bill, criminalizing custodial sexual misconduct. In March of this year, Amnesty International released this report describing violations of the human rights of women incarcerated in prisons and jails in the U.S. It revealed widespread forms of torture and, in some cases, cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment of women prisoners, including rape by correctional officials, groping during pat-down searches, prurient viewing of female prisoners in showers and bathrooms, and retaliation against those who dare to complain. Allegations of rape and other sexual coercion must be investigated and prosecuted under sexual assault laws. But the legislation on sexual misconduct should also include all forms of sexual contact as a violation of the employee's duty, which makes the consent of the inmate irrelevant. And I know that some have concerns about prescribing through legislation the capacity of adults to consent to adult behavior. However, it is our view that where this kind of custodial relationship exists, that the consent of an inmate who is in the custody of a correctional official is not really possible to give. This relationship is unique, and therefore we believe that it is very important that consent not be an affirmative defense to custodial sexual misconduct by correctional officials. Aware of the need to prevent sexual misconduct in women's prisons, the National Institute of Corrections, part of the U.S. Justice Department, provides training and advice to correctional authorities on all forms of sexual misconduct. Legislation covering federal prisons does prohibit such misconduct, but in 8 states now, including Oregon, it is not yet criminalized. And with that comment, I would just draw your attention to this other document entitled The State of Laws and Lawlessness. This is a survey of each of the U.S. states, providing you with information on the existing custodial misconduct laws. And I would just point out in this opening paragraph where it says the following states have no laws, some of this has changed since this document was drafted. West Virginia, Washington, Virginia, Nebraska, and Montana have all passed custodial sexual misconduct laws, very similar, if not identical, in substance to the one before you today. Once again, West Virginia, Washington, Virginia, Nebraska, and Montana of this list of the original 14 that did not have those laws. In addition, Minnesota, of course, Oregon, and Vermont do have laws in committee, bills in committee at this point. Whether or not a state has a large female detainee population, and whether or not complaints have been brought forward, we believe it is the duty of the state to provide the protection to which incarcerated women are entitled. Legislation punishing sexual misconduct by a person employed at or under contract to work with prisoners or detainees of the Department of Corrections is an effective way of preventing such behavior. Deterrence and accountability are key in a context where there is such an imbalance of power between inmates and correctional officials, and where detainees totally depend on prison staff for basic necessities. Amnesty International's position is not meant as an indictment of the current correctional system, but rather as to provide a means of strengthening that system. Indeed, whenever it may be the case that a very few individuals among a very fine core of professional correctional staff may be inclined to stray down the path that can lead to offenses such as custodial sexual misconduct, this threatens the institutional integrity of an otherwise fine correctional system. Without this legislation, the state remains at risk for costly civil action. And I would point out that in 1998, the state of Washington settled out of court for somewhere in the neighborhood of $250,000 to Heather Wells, who was impregnated by a correctional official at the Purdy State Correction Center. So there is precedent where the lack of criminal legislation in this regard can lead to costly civil action for states. Amnesty International hopes that Oregon will join the now 42 states that, by adopting similar laws, have recognized that female inmates need protection. Please join us in supporting House Bill 3522. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And of course, committee at Oregon for years has had rules that prohibited this type of activity. And we passed legislation years ago that, for instance, on pat down, that you couldn't do an office that pat down that had to be done by someone of the same sex. So we have taken steps to try and alleviate this concern.
Well, Mr. Chair, I thought that we still had the, what they call the bikini rule, was still in place in Oregon. I'm not sure if that's still the case or not. And perhaps Mary can fill me in. At one point in time, if there were no female guards available or female staff available, they had what they called the bikini line pat down capability. You couldn't go beyond the line of a bikini bathing suit in a search pattern. Is that still the case? I'm not sure if it's not. Okay.
All right. Other questions for Dennis? If not, Mary, for a call, you will invite Representative Lowe to testify. Hello.
Good afternoon, committee. It's nice to see you again. I'm Representative Kathy Lowe from House District 26. I have some handouts for you from May today. Most of my remarks were introductory to introduce you to good business. Well, Mary, I apologize for being gone. We were under a call of the House. I'm really grateful that you're considering this bill. I think it's a good one, and I think we need it. I'd like to commend our public employees for the difficult and oftentimes dangerous jobs that they carry out in our correctional institutions every day. I'm testifying to the Dash 3 Amendment, which reflects the original language and intent of this bill. It sets a legal standard that sexual relationships between institutional custodians and inmates are not tolerated in our prisons, be they consensual or otherwise. This legislation gives Oregon the opportunity to be proactive in protecting the most basic right of those in custody by recognizing the intrinsic power of a custodian over an inmate. For this reason, HB 3522 explicitly states that consent cannot be used as a defense. I would like to point out that the state has criminalized other forms of consensual relationships when the balance of power favors one party. For example, statutory rape laws are based on an assumption that the party under 18 years of age doesn't have the same consensual power and cannot give consent. I provided each of you just now with a copy of House Resolution 357, currently pending in the United States House of Representatives. H.R. 357 not only encourages this legal standard, but further maintains that a state that fails to implement the legislation shall have their Title II funds otherwise allocated reduced by 10%. It's not prudent for us to sit on our hands and wait for them to tell us what to do. Oregon has a tradition of being proactive in this, and especially in protecting people's most basic rights. I'm grateful to you, as I said, for considering this bill, and I await your questions.
Other questions? Senator Carno.
Kathy, where's this bill out now in Congress? Have you heard where it's at?
I'm sorry, I'm a little hard of
hearing. Where is 357 at now?
I don't know the present status of it. Dennis might. Dennis?
I believe since the last time I testified, the status is unchanged.
Okay, it's still probably sitting in the committee like a lot of ours. I think all but eight states have legislation like this now, and Oregon is among the last eight to do this. I have had conversations with corrections and various police agencies at county level that have custody and make custody, and they favor this for the most part. It will give them a tool. The bottom line is that if they're charged with a crime, even if it's not a felony, even if it's just a misdemeanor, that means that they won't be going to work in that same job in some other state or a little bit later down the road in our state. It keeps them out of the employment loop if they are predators like this. And again, I say most of our public servants do a heck of a job. But the lovely thing about this is that it will give them an additional training tool to say, don't even go there. This is what the consequence is. And I would think that most of the labor people and the people in Department of Corrections would welcome this additional tool to help them keep control over the prison population. Because anytime somebody engages in custodial sexual misconduct, it puts the whole prison at risk, the inmates as well as the officers. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you for your testimony. I'd now invite Mary Bogdan and David Stain. And by the way, Mary, I think your letter on Gene Gerstler's birthday received the most guffaws and most applause.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to, like, recover with the good senator on that.
He loves it.
I think you'll find it strange.
I have a couple of bills I might give him to release.
That may not happen. He did it.
Like the letter. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin, representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. We came here prepared to support the legislation today. And at the risk of sounding somewhat unprofessional, in spite of Amnesty International's testimony, we're probably not going to oppose the bill. I have to say that we have one of the best correctional systems in the country. There are no documented instances of rape, brutality, torture, or other forms of violence against inmates by correctional staff. Because our correctional staff, even if I didn't represent them, have high degree of training, they're highly professional. The few incidences of sexual misconduct that we have reported have by and large been reported by correctional staff. And they've not included rape and violent acts of torture. And, you know, while our staff would support the idea that you must conduct yourself in a professional manner, the inflammatory comments by Amnesty International make it very difficult to sit here before this committee and support a bill that somehow insinuates that those behavioral patterns are occurring in Oregon. We think that the bill as a misdemeanor is better than it was as a felony. Mr. Chair, Senator Tarnow, you're right. We have very strict rules. It's very simple in Oregon. If you're involved in an inappropriate relationship with an inmate in this state, you lose your job. It's just that simple. Period. And it's not just female inmates that try to compromise the staff at an institution. It is also the male inmates who try to compromise the female staff at an institution. We spend a lot of time training and working with our staff to understand what is appropriate and what is inappropriate. We're probably not going to oppose this bill because Mr. Cook tells us it's okay. And that it probably makes some sense and that it does answer some of the litigation issues that could be brought forward. I just don't ever want to give an inmate an inch when it comes to filing suit against employees, whether they're founded or unfounded. And you know, it's been my experience in the last 15 years of representing corrections officers, and I'm sure that Senator Tarnow would be able to also verify this, that inmates, by and large, are folks that sit around trying to figure out ways to compromise the system. And I don't want to do that. I just think that our staff is so superior, and I'm sorry that Amnesty International has 40-some-odd states that don't have the professionalism that we have in Oregon. And I'm sorry, they need to pass legislation. They should just increase their training programs. You don't work in corrections very long. Staff don't tolerate other staff that compromise the security of the institution or the behavior of their coworkers. It's just not tolerated. And if it's not reported and somebody suspects it, you're not going to work there long. They just don't put up with it in their coworkers. So I don't have any other comments. I just was so offended by the insinuation that there's somehow rape and torture occurring in our institutions that I don't have any other comments.
Questions for Mary?
Mr. Chair,
I
would agree with Mary that I have never known of rape or torture. And in 22 years in being associated with a county correctional facility, I only had one case of where there was a consensual affair, if you will. And under this bill, I think a consensual relationship would be a problem for the particular officer involved. The problem I had was, how do you discipline when the partner, the inmate, was unwilling to cooperate? Which is a different issue, Mr. Chair. But for the most part, I agree with everything you said. Thank you.
Mr. Fedanke.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, David Fedanke, Executive Director, ACLU of Oregon. I am also reluctant to appear before you on this bill, not so much because of what I'm about to testify to, but in amazement that so many other states have apparently already passed legislation like this. I'm here to testify in opposition to this bill. The ACLU is adamantly opposed to any sexual contact between prison or jail inmates and corrections officers. However, we do not believe that the abuses in other states should be used as an excuse to pass a criminal statute in the state of Oregon which holds corrections officers strictly liable for any sexual contact and makes consent irrelevant in that criminal proceeding. That is our biggest problem with this bill, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. We spent many decades trying to rid from Oregon criminal law statutes that criminalize sexual conduct between consenting adults. Now, that is not to say for a second that sexual contact between jail or prison inmates and corrections officers is ever appropriate. It's not. And those corrections officers should be fired if they did engage in such sexual contact. And that can be done now. It is done now. And those corrections officers are banned from that occupation for the rest of their lives. We believe that is as stiff a punishment as is appropriate in a circumstance, particularly a circumstance where the corrections officer was in fact seduced by an inmate rather than the corrections officer preying on an inmate. If this bill becomes law, that would be irrelevant. The -3A3 amendments would make that completely irrelevant. The Ayn Gross bill makes consent completely irrelevant for sections 3 and 4. And section 2 has this weird affirmative defense language that we think is going to cause problems. There may be some way.
Are you referring to there?
I'm referring to subsection 2, sub 2, lines 15 through 17 on the Ayn Gross bill. The section 2 of the Ayn Gross bill is just very confusing in the way that it's written. If the committee is intent on criminalizing this behavior, which we would not support if it makes no provision for, yes, the A3s.
Are you referring to the A3s in your comment?
I was referring, in my last comment, I was referring to the A and gross bill.
Okay.
The A3s eliminate that affirmative defense altogether and, again, would make a flat-out provision in all three sections that consent is not a defense. That we are adamantly opposed to. Because, in essence, it imposes strict liability for a criminal offense, which we believe is inappropriate.
Okay.
Would you say again,
the sections that we are opposed to in, if you want to look at the Dash 8-3 amendments, shows up in Section 2, lines 18 and 19, and Section 3, lines 11 and 12. In the A. Gross bill, it's the language that shows up on page 2, line 2, and line 9. And Section 2 of the bill deals with it a little bit differently. Mr. Chair, the other, I think there are two potentially unintended consequences if this legislation is passed. One is that it may make it more difficult to act quickly in an administrative proceeding to discipline an employee if there is the potential of that employee facing criminal charges, because they will be put in the position of either having to waive their right against self-incrimination and face jeopardy in the criminal setting, or trying to delay the administrative proceeding until it's clear what the outcome will be in the criminal proceeding. So it may actually make it more difficult to discipline corrections officers who are acting inappropriately in the workplace. And again, I think the other unintended consequence is that when most people think of this problem, they think of female inmates being victimized by male guards. And in fact, we suspect that it will be female corrections officers who have been victimized by male inmates that may more frequently be the victims of this new crime. We think it is adequate to fire any corrections officer who engages in any sexual contact with an inmate, and they should be fired. We do not believe that we need to criminally prosecute them.
Questions for Mr. Day? Mr. Taylor, because it's class A misdemeanor, if you were convicted of the first degree offense, you would not have to register as a sexual offender, correct?
Sure, it's not on the list. We did have a bill earlier that the state police brought us, which did tie into federal requirements and money. And you may remember that we had difficulty on some of those misdemeanor sex offenses because they were added to the list because the federal law required it tied to the federal burn ban. So they had federal.
If you would check that out for me before you go into work session. Senator Duncan, what that involved was, if you're on that list and say you were convicted under this statute, you'd never have the right to have a firearm again, go hunting, both those things, because you'd have to register as a sexual offender. So it's that part to be serious, in addition to being a class A misdemeanor.
Chair, this is not on the list, because it is not on the list.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have to tell you, if that is the case, it would severely change. I mean, we would, Appleton would have an entirely different position on this bill.
Well, we'll ask this chair to come back to the committee with an answer.
And, Bill, I'd be happy to work with you on that. And I just kind of looked back at the Department of Corrections, and they shrugged their shoulders. So that does put a different spin on this. If our kids could never go hunting again, they'd have my head. And yours too, probably.
Well, they could go hunting again, but if they fall within the purview of the federal act, they'd be committing a federal felony. Tim Duncan, did you have a question?
Oh, two questions. One, Mary, is there a grievance procedure in place right now to challenge the firings under these circumstances?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, the short answer is yes. You always have the right to representation when you're terminated. Understand that our obligation for representation is to be sure that your rights are protected under the contract and that you have been fired correctly and that the allegations against you are true. It only protects your right to representation and defense. It does not protect your right to continue to work if those charges are upheld. So if it is a lawful termination and the charges that have been levied against you by an inmate are deemed to be true and accurate, then you would not retain your right to employment. We would lose the grievance.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
Are you going to have the other people testify?
No, these are our final two witnesses.
Okay, that's the question I have. Are there other situations you can think of in the law where there would be a criminal violation or sexual misconduct? I try to put myself in the situation. Obviously, if there's one with a student, because then that becomes a statutory rape situation in those cases, so that would be a criminal action. Are there any other situations where you can think of where someone would be come under the provisions of the criminal act, even a consensual sex?
If an officer, Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, if an officer forced himself on an inmate, he's guilty of rape, or she is guilty of rape. I mean, it's
a forced situation, yes.
Or assault, a sexual assault at least.
I guess I was just concerned about the consensus.
Right.
And then the other kind of study where that would be, where it would be a criminal violation.
Unwelcome touching in a sexual manner is also not only involved, but you can go into sexual offenses by the touching also. So that's already covered by statute.
But
the consensual, that changes all
things.
Mr. Chair, if I could address that briefly, I believe that the only situations where consent would not be at issue, or potentially at issue, in sex offenses are sex offenses involving minors. And even there, there are some exceptions if the minor is within 3 years of age, younger than the...
Yeah, mentally deficient people also can't give
right.
Mentally incompetent. Other questions?
Okay.
Yes.
Who
produced the Dash 3 amendments to you? Kathy? Okay, they came from Representative Wolf. Thank you. We'll close the public hearing and open the public hearing now on House Bill 3084 and Representative Kathy. I'll also invite Steve Ingold to stand to me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Rob Passage, representing House District 60, which is the city of Medford. Passed out of House Judiciary criminal judiciary, House Bill 3084, and is before you today. The reason I brought this bill is to provide another tool for prosecutors in the state of Oregon. Currently, many jurisdictions across the state do what may be called a deferred sentence or conditional discharge for their misdemeanor, typically first-time misdemeanor offenses in the state of Oregon in order to clear dockets very quickly in order to hold people accountable. The problem has been, though, from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, some judges have not agreed that the statute provides for some kind of conditional discharge deferred sentencing kind of program. That's why I brought this before you today. Currently what we have is a diversion program that is in the statutes in the state of Oregon. That will continue to be allowed. Diversion would mean that the DA's office would defer a sentence until the person, the offender, completed some types of programs. What a conditional discharge in House Bill 3084 would allow the district attorney's office to take a plea up front on the charge. That way it would hold the person more accountable. Then they would complete the terms of the probation. Then following the terms of the probation, the case could be dismissed against them if they continued to fulfill those terms. The reason that this is necessary is, one, again, from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, it's recognized in some but not in others. But secondly, this allows for higher accountability and also helps clear the dockets at sheriff's offices and other things. If on a diversion type of case, you have to keep all the evidence for the case. You have to maintain a whole different set of records. This would allow for someone to plead guilty up front. Then the evidence and other things can be disposed of back to the victims and other items. If the person failed on their probation, you wouldn't have to go back and try the case. The person has already admitted their guilt. It's a technical bill, basically. It's not intended to change any of the deferred sentences across the state, but it allows those jurisdictions that want and choose to use a conditional discharge as a means of working with their criminal population within their counties to do so. So
don't many jurisdictions already do this?
No, many jurisdictions in Oregon don't. And some of the courts won't recognize that they can take a plea up front.
But some do.
Some do. But some don't because there's no statute on point.
Authority.
So we wanted to give the statutory authority for them to be able to do this. A lot of jurisdictions, I think Marion County courts have recognized that, but other courts and other jurisdictions have not, and DAs would like this as a tool in terms of a lot of those. Dale Penn, unfortunately, could not be here today. He does have an amendment for this that I'm not opposed to, and they're going to have that draft.
You could identify yourself for the record.
Steve Dingle, with the Marion County District Attorney's Office and the Oregon District Attorney's Association. We do favor this bill, and as was stated, a lot of the courts do not recognize, we call them DA diversions, that's what we call them, and they're on non-DUI charges on other misdemeanors. Some courts do not recognize those, do not recognize our right to extract a lower plea up front, and that's the point was made. I just got through today, as a matter of fact, looking through about 300 or 400 cases for a local police department. If they divert without a plea, then they have to hang on to the evidence. If they fail to appear for their show proof date, it could be 5-6 years down the road. The only thing that we would like added to this bill, and it's my understanding that Mr. Penn has spoke with Representative Patridge about this, is an exclusion for domestic violence cases. There has been the only dissension I can say that there's been within our association is the concern that this somehow runs afoul some of the specific programs of the deferred sentence type programs that are in place in various counties for domestic violence. For example, I talked to Helen Smith in Multnomah County this morning. We have such a program in place in Marion County, and I know that there are other counties around the state that do that. So. We would like it clear that in the statute that this does not eliminate that or that somehow those programs are in conflict with this.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that was the intent, and that's why I don't object to having that in as a specific provision. Mr. Penn has asked that legislative council to draft that amendment, and I don't perceive any problems with that.
When those are ready, why don't you let Ms. Taylor know and we'll reschedule for work session.
Thank you.
Questions for these two witnesses?
Thank you, Ms. Tank.
We'll then close the public hearing. And we will open a public hearing on HJR 82, invite Bob Shipwreck, Mary Lodkin, and John Gervais.
Chairman, for the record, I'm Bob Shipwreck, representing the Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council. I'm here today in support of HJR 82. Before the session got started, a number of us went and spoke to Representative Mannix, who crafted Ballot Measure 17, and shared with him some of the concerns that we had about the what we felt were unintended impacts of Measure 17, in that it was pretty tightly written, and we felt that the Department of Corrections would appreciate more flexibility, at least in discussions I've heard of, and more direction from the legislature on how to implement it. We had further discussions with the governor's office. They shared our opinions. Representative Mannix then crafted HJR 82, which is in front of you today after having passed the House. Just a little bit, and I'll be trying to be as brief as possible. The last two large prisons, one is currently under construction at Umatilla. There was another one that's, for all intents and purposes, finished in Ontario. There was a number of approximately about 100 inmates used in the construction of those facilities, displacing construction workers that hadn't committed crimes, and it's led to a great deal of consternation amongst my membership, and also has led to problems in the bidding process, in that some contractors simply refuse to use inmate labor. You're not going to get a good mix of bids on some of these projects. I'm not here to bash the Corrections Department. They've been extremely helpful and forthright, and also understanding that the problems that they're facing. I'd also point out the committee, it's our understanding, and we can argue figures back and forth all day, that the use of inmates in this particular fashion does not save the state money. Correctional people needed to supervise these folks, the threat and possibility of sabotage and other things leads to high correctional costs. Plus, I went and visited the Snake River facility, and I have to tell you, as a construction worker, these guys aren't very productive. It was quite a scene. I've got some letters. This was not solicited by me. These are from people who belong to my association. These happen to be heat and frost insulators who have been displaced at the Umatilla project. Two of them have lost their health and welfare insurance. They're working part-time while inmates do their job. These folks typically work on large industrial or commercial projects. They need this work. Their contractors need it. I'm also here today, as might surprise you, I'm also speaking for Betsy Earls of Associated Oregon Industry, who helped put this together with us. They support the legislation, as it will attempt to give again the legislature and the governor a little bit more authority in how these inmate work programs are operated, and so that they do not compete with the private sector. Also here, I spoke to Nan Heim, who represents the developmentally disabled small businesses, if you will. One of these
were put out of business in the valley. You might have read that. They're protected under this bill, and she also asked me to tell the committee that they support the legislation as well. I'll stop at that point and ask for any questions. And I did have one technical thing, Mr. Chairman. Mary and I both used to sit on an advisory committee that advised the department, and so we knew quite a bit about pen industries or whatever. I should mention there's a companion bill that would implement this, and I read it and I forgot the bill number, but Representative Mannix is bringing forth that would set up another group of individuals and legislators to oversee some of these decisions. But I was going to ask you, Mr. Chairman, who the A3 amendments are, because I wanted to comment that, and I would defer to the Department of Corrections, but it was my understanding that interstate commerce with prison-made goods led to problems with the feds, and I think this...
With the audit schedule, that's why,
okay.
Then why don't you come forward now and... the federal statute you're referring to is the one that requires a prevailing wage to be paid as an interstate commerce.
Senator Bryant, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Benjamin DeHaan. I'm the deputy director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. The issue that Mr. Shiprack referred to was indeed a problem, and we took care of that last legislative session. When we went out to the, we did a similar thing in the last session, and then we modified some internal practices with regard to compensation to take care of that. But it was an issue that I believe that's taken care of.
And the dash A3, everyone's in agreement with those?
Yes, sir.
Mary?
The only thing I'm going to state, for the record, I'm Mary Botkin, representing the American Federation of State Senate Municipal Employees, represent the officers within the institution. We just want to say that HJR 82 was drafted with our help, and we're supportive of this measure. We believe that work programs are as critical a part of the security of the institution as any other program that we have there, and that without good work programs, the security of the institution becomes compromised. Idle inmates are a threat, and that's not what we want, but we think it's possible to keep them working without taking the jobs of otherwise law-abiding citizens. And I will say that in the years that Bob and I served on the Penn Industries Board, while we gritched about it on a regular basis, we actually did enjoy working with the department and with the business community and making sure that the projects that were moved forward made sense. I just want to say that the Prison Blues was enacted while we were on the board. The Yoshida program was enacted while we were on the board. You know, it kind of feels sometimes like we get accused of never approving any work programs because we didn't allow inmates to unfairly compete with law-abiding citizens. And we were very careful about making sure that the programs that we put in place did not unfairly displace citizens working in the community already. And I think this does what needs to be done. It keeps the spirit of the law intact while adjusting it in a way that does not provide for unfair competition with the business community and the private sector. And we would pass it.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I just might make a comment for the record, since comment was made about Nan Hine and the disabled people workers. And so that I don't appear inconsistent, because I'm supportive of what you're trying to do, and I've been adamant about not changing that particular program. And I think they're very different concepts. And
yep.
So I was just, I didn't close. That's what I mean. She was going to say, he's being inconsistent. And I don't feel I'm being inconsistent. I see that it's very different kinds of things.
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, while we were on the board, Bob and I denied a couple of projects because they would displace disabled folks doing similar work. And We just didn't feel like it was appropriate.
Mr. Chair, it seems to me like in those particular programs, they're working, they're earning part of their livelihood. They could get jobs elsewhere. So I just wanted to kind of get that on the record because I thought I might be able to be accused of being inconsistent. I've never been in this
yeah.
in my life.
No, every bill that hasn't wouldn't do anything on the floor. John, would you like to add anything further?
Mr. Chair, I came here prepared to go through the provisions of the bill, but it's fairly straightforward. There are five or six points. I think that you can see that. We just want to offer our support and also our support for the AC amendments. I'm happy to go through the individual items if you choose, but I don't think you choose.
I don't think that's true.
Okay. Well, then I'm fine.
Very good.
Before you leave today, I do have a question for you on Health Bill 3522. We'll ask you in the hallway after this next witness.
Thank you.
All right. President Gargan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, State Representative Dan Gargan from House District 13, and it sounds like the previous speakers have clearly covered all the aspects of the bill, and in the interest of time, just appreciate your support on the bill. I believe that law-abiding, tax-paying citizens should not be displaced out of their jobs, and that this bill goes a long way toward clearing up some interpretations that have been out there, and for your support for it. Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we'll close in the public hearing on HJR 82, open the work session.
I move the -83 amendments to House Joint Resolution 82.
Thank you, Senator Courtney. Has moved the -83 amendments. All right. Is there discussion? Objection? Hearing then so ordered.
I move House Joint Resolution 82 as amended to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Courtney moves HJR 82 as amended before due pass. Discussion? Objection? So ordered.
I love the carry, but I'm a team player. That's what? He's doing all the carrying. This is the guy who does all the carrying.
No, I'm selective.
Yeah, I know. So do I.
Senator Brown will carry it. She's on there. We'll now open the public hearing and help Bill 2096. And I invite David Micon, Joe McKeever, and Annette Talbot.
I didn't know any. You can give it to me.
I just want to talk to you. I have a question for Tom. Those three in favor.
Okay, of course, we don't hear that you're in favor of this bill, so of course the testimony will be what you call June testimony. Give special testimony in the month of June here. I just made that up, but I love it. It's a way of speaking to you.
Take your time.
Whoever's going to start.
Thank you. I'm David Meiser, Executive Secretary of the Future Standards and Practices Commission. With me is Joe McKeever today, who represents our agency from the Attorney General's office. The commission asks that House Bill 2096 be introduced to deal with the problem that we have encountered with certain of the discipline cases in which we are required to investigate alleged misconduct by educators. In one such case, an educator was accused of statutory rape of a student, but was later acquitted of that. However, in the course of the investigation by police, it was determined that the educator had taken a female student, a sophomore, from the high school campus to his apartment and inappropriately touched the student and kissed her, but it was never proven that anything beyond that occurred, and he was acquitted on the charge of statutory rape. The commission, however, looked into this matter and felt that the behavior was so egregious that it warranted revoking the license. In such a case, the police records and the court proceedings are often sealed, and without a police investigation report to conduct our investigation and develop the evidence, it's very difficult to proceed on these cases. Mr. McKeever will speak to you about the intent of the change that is proposed here, and we'll be glad to answer any questions.
Senator Courtney, members of the committee, my name is Joel McKeever. I'm legal counsel to the Teachers Standards and Practices Commission, and I'm an assistant attorney general. I have written testimony that I failed to give to the clerk, but I'll do that at this point. In light of the fact that we're in the month of June, I don't know that I have more to add unless there are specific questions for committee members. All right. Well, as I started to say, I wasn't sure whether there is a need for me to go beyond the written testimony that I provided unless there are specific questions or concerns that committee members have, or if there's a desire that I go into some more detail in explaining the purpose or...
No, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. You're going to read the entire testimony? Don't you ask me if you need to do...
No, Senator. No, Senator, I didn't intend to do that. I can summarize it further if that is the desire of the committee, or indicate to you.
So we're talking about police report. I want to just quickly. We're talking about police reports, investigation. We're not talking about convictions.
We are dealing with an amendment to the criminal expungement statute, which provides that in the case of an expungement of a conviction, or in the case of an arrest that later does not result in a conviction, court records and police records are sealed. We often find that those records contain important information that hinders our investigation if we can't have access to them. This merely gives the commission and other agencies standing to go to the court and request and make a showing that the court may release to the agency police reports under whatever restrictions the court may want to impose.
So, Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir, Dr.
It seems like what you're saying, that you could have a situation where there were no charges filed against the individual, but yet when you read the police report, there were things in there you thought were unbecoming a teacher to hold a license to teach in Oregon schools. You could remove the license even without a conviction.
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, that is correct. Most of these, there has been a charge filed, but the person that later acquitted or the charges were dropped.
Okay. Thank you. I recognize her.
Mr. Chair, member of the Met Public Legislative Coordinator for the Employment Department. You have, I believe, before you the A5 amendments, which would add the Telstar Division of the Employment Department to the definition of professional licensing agency. We believe that the way that the bill is narrowly constructed at this point in time, we might at some point in time like to take advantage of petitioning the court for the same kind of information. We do obviously license and register child care providers who have unsupervised contact with children and therefore have some of the same concerns that the Teachers and Standards Practices Commission does, and they have graciously said they do not object to our amendment. So if that would be something that the committee would look favorably on, we would certainly ask you to adopt the A5 amendments, but we don't want to add any controversy to the bill or slow it up in any way. Thank you.
To the committee, have you described the process you go through on a hearing so that what in this case the teacher or a nurse or someone would be entitled to as far as the due process?
Mr. Chair, I can't speak for the other licensing boards, but under TFCC, a person is entitled to notice of the charge and opportunity for hearing. And if a hearing is conducted, we're represented by the Attorney General's Office, and Joe McKeever can speak to that process.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think that process that's described by Mr. Mighton would apply to just about all licensing agencies as required by the Administrative Procedure Act. There is a requirement for a contested case hearing for right of representation by the professional, and we don't... we're not introducing this bill as a means of simply using the police report as evidence against the educator. I think in almost all cases that would be insufficient. We look at this as a basis for us to develop information so that we can independently investigate the facts. Oftentimes it is the police that are first on the scene, and develop important information in the first instance, and we're sometimes looking at this months later.
Wouldn't also you need the person to testify, otherwise the report would be hearsay, unless the other party stipulated the information?
Well, that's generally correct, Mr. Chairman. However, under APA, hearsay under some circumstances is admissible. I think if it was certainly an important part of the evidence, it would be necessary to have the officer there to testify. We, under the present state of affairs, we oftentimes don't even know who the investigating police officers are because we don't have access to their reports. Moreover, because the records are sealed, the police officers don't have access to their own reports so that they can refresh their recollections to be able to testify about events on which they may have firsthand knowledge. So those are reasons why we think that this bill makes a fairly minor change, but an important one for us, for the commission to carry out its function.
And the burden of proof is on the state agency trying to remove the license. Is there no burden of proof?
The burden of proof is on, Mr. Chairman, is on the agency, which is seeking to take disciplinary action.
Senator Brown.
I just want to follow up on a question that Senator Turner asked, and because of my unfamiliarity with the process in terms of the licensing, and that is could a report in and of itself be sufficient to yank the license?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, it's hard for me to answer that categorically. I cannot imagine a case where you're dealing with the license of a professional that a hearsay police report alone would be sufficient to revoke a professional license.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
The reason I ask that question is that a little bit of my legal background has been as a lawyer in juvenile court handling abuse and neglect cases, and I'm extremely concerned that we're opening a can of worms here in terms of using police reports, unfounded allegations, etc. I just am really concerned about that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, I think that's a legitimate concern, and when we had hearings in the House, one of the opponents of the bill pointed out, I think rightfully, that police reports often are one-sided, may not contain totally accurate information. It would not be our intent to use the reports as substantive evidence in the case, but we do think that they are important in order for the agency to conduct its own investigation to find out what information was at least immediately developed by the police, or even to be able to identify persons who have information about the matter. When the police reports are sealed, we often will be unable to do that.
Sorry, Carter.
No, I don't think you can say what you just said. I think it's conceivable the SBC could yank a license on a police report in and of itself. They could make that decision. You can't say they couldn't make it.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, they could make it. I'm not sure if it would be upheld by the Court of Appeals. What the APA says is that evidence which can be relied upon by persons in their normal affairs is admissible. So that's a looser standard than in circuit court. However, there is at least one Supreme Court case that has said reliance on hearsay alone in an allegation of misconduct against a professional may not be sufficient to meet APA standards. So
I report too to be hearsay on hearsay. I don't see how that thing that to me behind the likely to be used as the sole reason to hear the license.
Chairman?
Yes, I'm ready.
How would you find out that there were sealed records anyway? I mean, how do they come to light? How do you even know about the existence of sealed records?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, in our case, we have a requirement that superintendents report to us when they believe that an educator has committed an act that would warrant investigation by the commission. And so many times we get that report from the district, but in trying to follow up on that report,
and look for the police investigation materials and so on, we've been unable to get the additional supporting documentation.
Mr. Chairman, that's public again. In our case, it's usually a complaint based. A provider, someone says about the provider, well, we know they've had X and such in their history, and if it doesn't show up on the web's computer as a conviction, we wouldn't know about it. Nonetheless, we might be concerned enough about it that we want to further investigate whatever witnesses were in the police report. We wouldn't rely on the police report itself either. So.
Follow up. And then, if I understand it, that if you chose to yank somebody's license or whatever based on the police report, what you saw there, you didn't have the police officer there, and the Court of Appeals does not consider, the police officer wouldn't get a chance to testify at the Court of Appeals, is that correct? If they don't take de novo, they base their appeal on the record, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Burdick, yes, that's correct. So I think the point I was trying to make that is that, at least on one Supreme Court case, the indication is that if you're basing something, an important matter such as a license revocation, solely on hearsay, that may be reversible error, and the court would say the decision of the agency to revoke the license was in error and would reverse it.
My recollection of the expungement statute is that you're looking at, generally speaking, a minimum of 3 years and potentially more. What would be our outside limit in terms of, is it a potential open-ended? So potentially the record could be 25 years old?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, yes, that could be. It would seem to me unlikely that, you know, if we're looking at professional misconduct, it seems fairly recent in which the agency is interested.
Mr. Chair, so, but in this bill, still at the minimum, you're looking at records that are over 3 years old, for the most part, correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, not necessarily. The bill involves not only convictions that have been expunged, but also records that have been sealed as a result of an arrest there's been an arrest but no conviction, where the charges have either been dropped or there's been an acquittal. And in fact, that's the situation which causes us, I think, the more difficulty. And charges are dropped and prisons are acquitted for any number of reasons. Some of them, obviously, that the person's been found not guilty, but there may be other conduct that the police have uncovered that is in addition to whatever the charges involve.
Ms. Taylor.
Taylor, you mentioned the situation of a school teacher and a school police officer. In that situation, are you allowed to subpoena him, the teacher? You obviously have some kind of element in the police report. And you're allowed to subpoena him in the teacher, are you not?
Mr. Chairman, and Senator Taylor, yes, that's correct.
And
I'm sorry.
I'm
sorry.
The teacher and the teacher refuses to testify. Can you then take their license or refuse to testify?
Well, I think I'm familiar with the TSPC procedures, and under their rules, I don't think that the refusal to testify would be a basis alone for disciplinary action. The commission could, of course, draw inferences by the teacher's failure to respond to questions.
Thank you. One further question. Do you have the ability to subpoena him as a student?
Yes, sir, we do. Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Other questions, Chief? We have other witnesses. I would invite Brad Swank, Henry Kaplan, and Ingrid Clinton.
Mm-hmm.
Brad, I'll begin with you.
Chair Brian, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Plank. I'm the State Court Administrator's Office. Actually, we're here on a technical point. Dan Gross House Bill 2096 has a provision in it that came in late in the House process when I met him on the House side. And several of my judges contacted me and asked me what dark crevice my head was in when it got away. They didn't notice it. And it's a provision about in-camera inspection. And in-camera inspection by courts is a provision that was put in late of these records, and it was a provision that they put in to allow a judge to inspect these records so that the judge could see whether there was anything in there for the licensing agency to look at. We took a look at the licensing agencies that are covered by the board, and first of all, I was told by my judges that in-camera inspections can take a considerable amount of time by a judge to go through records and inspect the records and analyze the records. And we took a look at the number of licensees that potentially we're talking about. The Teacher Standards and Practices Commission alone has 70,000-plus licensed teachers. They have a budget to license an additional 30,000 by this next biennium. The bar has 11,000 to 14,000 members of the bar. There are 22 other agencies that are specifically mentioned or referred to in the bill. And that's not an exclusive list by the language of the bill. So you're talking a potential 180 to 200,000 licensed people that potentially could be subject to discipline or review or new abilities that are applying that, that they may want to have, even if they have records inspected on a small percentage of these, it could be a substantial amount of work for courts. Not only that, but it would probably, given the location of most licensing agencies, and of most of the records, it would probably be a disproportionate load on a small number of courts. I would guess probably Marion County and Multnomah County would get most of these petitions. And those are certainly the judges I heard from. We asked to have some amendments drafted, and those are the A4 amendments that set up a different process than having the judge doing in-camera inspection. If you decide to proceed with this, we would suggest the A4 amendments as a process that would be helpful to the courts, and we'll still retain the process for the agencies. I appreciate very much the fact that the committee staff did a hand-engrossed version of these for you to look at. Basically, the process that it would establish would be for the courts, upon application of the licensing agency, to establish, to designate a special master who would go look at the records and report back to the court. That would save judge time, and could still get somebody to do the analysis of the records, and the agency would be responsible for paying the cost of the special master. So those are the amendments we'll bring forward, and we request that if you proceed with this bill, you you add them to the bill and make those changes. And I can answer to any questions.
The master would be appointed by the presiding judge.
Yeah.
Questions for Mr. Plank? As you could testimony. Captain.
Chairman Bryan, members of the committee. My name is Henry Kaplan. I'm an attorney in private practice in Portland. I was the attorney in State versus KP, which is one of the cases referred to in Mr. McKeever's memorandum, which interpreting ORS 137-225, which is the statute which this bill purports to amend. I've also represented many individuals in licensed discipline hearings, including nurses, police officers, teachers, bus operators, and firefighters. And I'm here to speak in opposition to these changes to ORS 137.225. I've handed out some a written summary of commentary. Before I summarize my own summary, I just want to address some of the comments made by Mr. McKeever and Dr. Mike. First of all, the way this often comes up is a disgruntled arrestee accuses a police officer of physical or sexual assault, or a disgruntled parent unhappy with a teacher or even with the school district will encourage their child to report physical contact as either physically abusive or sexual, or sometimes the child itself decides to initiate a report, which for whatever reason does not prove out, at least as far as the criminal process is concerned. Then months or even years later, after the charges have been dismissed and the student is unwilling or unavailable to testify, or the criminal arrestee is unavailable, the agency offers the police report instead, and a person's license can be removed based on police reports alone. Now, this is not a chimerical hypothetical, because we have an Oregon Supreme Court case known as Ruggiero versus TSPC, which I believe is the case that Mr. McKeever referred to, which teaches us the danger of using hearsay police report statements in lieu of live testimony. In that case, the teacher had to go all the way to the Supreme Court of Oregon to get his license revocation reversed, because it was based solely on hearsay police reports, and the police reports themselves presented the flimsiest of evidence, which nevertheless takes on credibility by virtue of being written down. Keep in mind that the TSPC panel members are not lawyers, as well as the panel members of other licensing agencies are not lawyers, and perhaps some of them do not appreciate how much greater weight should be given to live testimony than police reports, which do in the minds of many bear an indicia of significant credibility. And so the situation has arisen, and it can arise again, because there's nothing in the Ruggiero case which precludes the agency, TSPC or any other licensing agency, from using hearsay police reports as a basis for a license revocation. The Supreme Court's decision in the Ruggiero case was very careful to say that we are not saying you cannot use hearsay as the sole basis for a license revocation. We just think that the evidence in this case is so obviously flimsy that we're going to reverse it. So that avenue is still available. I'm troubled, very troubled, by the fact that that this proposal makes specific reference to the use of these records in the agency's, quote, proceedings, end quote, not just in the agency's investigation. If the agency really needs these records to do its investigation, it should simply attempt to do a prompt investigation before the criminal case is over. This proposal appears to specifically contemplate that the court shall allow the agencies to use the reports in lieu of live evidence, and that's one of the things that I find troubling about it. Mr. McKeever said he felt it was unlikely that at least in the TSPC's situation, that it would that police reports would be used as were likely to be used as sole evidence, and indicated that there was some he and Dr. Martin indicated that there might have been some difficulty in obtaining the evidence. I submit to you that this has never been a real problem issue for the agency. As Dr. Martin indicated, there is a statute requiring school districts to immediately report misconduct which might rise to the level of being justification for a license revocation. And those reports come in promptly. Sometimes the commission, in fact, often the commission or the licensing agency may neglect or refuse to act until after the criminal proceedings are over, but there is no requirement that they do so. There's no reason that the commission cannot, upon receiving that report, immediately conduct an investigation before anything is sealed and while the witnesses are available. The effect of this revision to ORS 137-225 is basically simply to reward dilatory action by the licensing agency by making it easy for the licensing agency to still present the evidence which perhaps the licensing agency didn't vigorously pursue when the matter first came to their attention. I submit to you that in the example of the case that Dr. Martin gave, there was no trouble on the part of the agency obtaining the evidence because the students were still available. But had the students, had there been sufficient evidence that the students had not been available, then there would be exculpatory evidence that was no longer available to the educator who was accused.
Would most of your fears be allayed if something was added to the statute that the police report could not be used itself as testimony, except maybe for the exception of rebuttal?
That would go a long way towards alleviating the potential abuse of this statute, but it is still susceptible of abuse if the delay in the agency's proceedings causes the loss of evidence. You know, so in the example I gave, for instance, the arrestee is gone, or the student is no longer is either unavailable or unwilling to testify. Then the individual whose license is being attacked is prejudiced by this delay. And I emphasize, as I indicated in my written comments, that this is not a problem for those people who are actually convicted of a crime. This is not a problem for the agency attempting to revoke the license of those people convicted of a crime, because they're not even eligible for the expungement until 3 years after the conviction is entered and the sentence has been served. So typically we're talking about 4 to 6 years after the event occurred that the records would even be sealed for somebody who is guilty, who has been adjudicated guilty in the criminal justice system. This is only a problem for those people who have been arrested and for whom the evidence was deemed insufficient, either by the district attorney or by the jury that listened to the case.
Or sometimes the DA just decides not to prosecute.
Well, if there's never any arrest, if there's never any charge, one of the quirks of RS-137-225, and this is actually addressed in a case called Springer versus State, there's an equal protection challenge to the statute saying that it treats people who are arrested more favorably than people who aren't arrested. Ironically, people who were never arrested aren't eligible for the expungement ever.
Would you repeat your amendment you were thinking about earlier?
My amendment was that you can't use the police report as evidence. The exception might be for impeachment. So if the impeachment exception would be if someone says, no, I didn't say that to the police officer said, yes, you did, you could, as an exception, you say you can bring in something that was written at the time.
Well, there's actually a problem, as I think about it, there is a problem with that, and that is, if we're not talking about the police officer witnesses, but we're talking about, in a sense, double hearsay, because the report is hearsay and the police officer is reporting the statement of, say, a student or an arrestee charging a police officer with excess force. The report claims that the arrestee or the student said something. The student or the arrestee is not available, presumably not available, otherwise we don't have the problem, for cross-examination to determine whether they in fact ever actually said that. So to the extent that the report is being offered to impeach the testimony of the individual who says, I never did that, and it's a hearsay statement. It's not proper impeachment because let's say in the case of an educator, the educator is not being asked, did you say that, and the police officer's report says that you said that. In the to the contrary, it's being offered to impeach the educator indirectly because somebody else says the educator did something, and the educator doesn't know. I mean, it may well be true that the student said exactly what the police report says she said.
Trying to see if we should continue the question and allow Ingrid to get testimony.
Sure, if I could just bring out one point in this. I think you could use that statement under the evidence code now for prior.
Only if the report is referring to a statement of this individual, of the teacher who testified. Currently, you wouldn't need any pretext for using it. Currently, you could just put it in.
No, I think you got the point I was going to make. Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Reichert, Ingrid Simpson, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I guess, first of all, I just want to, we oppose this bill, and I just want to remind the committee that the expungement statute is a fairly narrow statute, which provides under very limited circumstances for a person in this state to either have destroyed or sealed the record of an arrest that did not result in a conviction for whatever reason, either because the district attorney decided not to file or that it was never pursued or it was dismissed prior to a prosecution. It also allows for expungement of a very narrow group of offenses when someone is convicted. Those are Class C felonies or misdemeanors, and it excludes certain misdemeanors such as mistreatment, and all sex offenses are excluded. All sex offenses are excluded from expungement.
So we're talking about minor theft. We're talking about some drug offenses. When you're convicted and you can actually get it expunged. The theory of the expungement provision has been that people get a second start if they only have this one event that occurred, this one error that they may have acted out in their life, and they get a second chance. And the statute specifically provides that when asked, have you been convicted of a crime, you may answer no, I have not. When we start to undermine that by giving people access to these records, which the statute carefully controls, it provides that they may not be disclosed by anyone. And as we know from the difficulties that the Clackamas County District Attorney has had, even district attorneys are required not to be disclosing or keeping this information once the court has said that this file is to be sealed or destroyed. Once you create a crack in that wall, you really undermine this whole theory of giving someone a second chance. I'm concerned for a number of reasons. Senator Burdick raised a good question about how do you find out about that police report anyway? And it's the existence of a statute such as House Bill 2096, as you passed it, would be an invitation for people who have knowledge about sealed or expunged convictions to anonymously report that fact to someone, even though the law prohibits that from occurring. Because there would be no way for you to know about that police report, except occasionally if the victim of a crime reported to you that the police responded and appeared to have taken a report and something occurred. But in most cases, that will not be known except by those people who are subject to the order of the court, provided that they not disclose this record or the contents of this record. If, in fact, the employing authority receives information from an appropriate and reliable source, then they already have an avenue for investigating the theft. They don't need to go searching around in the records of the state to see if some police report was written at some time. The example which was provided of a person who was acquitted of a sex offense, but who during the course of the investigation of that offense acknowledged other behavior, is exactly the sort of thing that you wouldn't want people to be doing. Fishing, basically, through police reports, not for information about the crime with which they were charged or for which they were arrested, but for other information that they may have gotten from somebody about something unrelated or at least marginally related to the alleged conduct. When I look at the structure for this bill, too, it raises other questions. The criminal defendant has an opportunity to object, but no ground is given for that objection. What would your objection be? My record is sealed. That's obviously not going to be a sufficient objection. It's not true. Well, the court says we're not here to determine whether it's true or not. So what can you object about? And when it requires the court to determine that it's relevant, it doesn't. How does the court know what's relevant without an elaborate procedure involving everything that's at stake in the licensing procedure, what the allegations might be? And there's no provision for reliability, for the court asking, well, it may be relevant if true, but on the face of this report, it doesn't even look reliable. And in view of the fact that the case was either dismissed, the defendant was acquitted in most cases, how can it be considered reliable just because it's in a police report? I guess my final comment would be, having practiced in the criminal courts for a number of years, just the existence of a police report causes a lot of people to believe it must be true. And in criminal cases, the report itself is not admissible for that, among other reasons, because it carries far too much weight just by virtue of the fact that it was generated by a police officer. One final comment, if I may, and that is in the House, they added on page one of the bill in line six, they changed the expungement law currently after a conviction, you're required to wait 3 years from the pronouncement of judgment before you can apply for expungement. And this bill would require that you wait either that 3 years or 3 years from the date you're released from custody. So that if you serve 30 days or 60 days on one of these charges or something of that sort, you would have to wait. I certainly didn't hear any great justification for that change. And as far as I know, the law has been functioning just fine. Most people who are eligible for expungement either get no jail sentence because the charge doesn't merit a prison or jail sentence, or the jail sentence would be extremely short. So I would also object to that piece.
I think, Ingrid, you raised some good points about the type of crimes that are eligible under this, and I'm having a hard time relating what would be relevant to teaching to the crimes that are accepted under the statute, with the possible exception of drug offenses. Do you have a sense of, and actually this is probably for you, but for the proponents, what kind of crimes we're looking at that are relevant to the teaching profession? Is all the child abuse, neglect, and sex abuse are not included?
And Mr. Vice Chair and Senator, Class C felonies, Class A misdemeanors, Class B misdemeanors, there's hundreds of them.
Okay.
There would be minor assaults, assaults in the fourth degree, assaults in the third degree, would include thefts in the second and third degree, and in the first degree in some cases, would include criminal mischief, damaging property of another person, could include the burglary of a non-residential structure, so some kind of a business structure. There are literally hundreds.
Million. Okay. Thank you.
I'm having trouble even putting my question together because there's a lot of confusion, at least confusion for me. But I guess what I'm getting down to is possibly the example that Dr. Knight mentioned earlier, sort of a known fact that something happened. I'm sure that word spreads among other students and so forth. Let me go back. I don't want that person, and maybe it's my own background, I don't want that person in my school. And I know the legal ramifications, all that sort of thing, and I believe in the law, but I also have a responsibility, a duty of care to a lot of students over here, and that person's effectiveness may very well be shy.
Tim and Brian.
I try to keep them as a teacher. I don't think that's what you're after, the concern you're after, Dave. I'm not sure if that's what it's after, but I'm trying to put this all together. And I, you know, you may be coming up from a legal standpoint, which I will appreciate. I'm sitting here trying to put myself in running the school and knowing what I don't want to happen in my school. So how do you reconcile all of this?
Chairman Brian, Senator Duncan, if I may respond to that. The example which you cited is one in which, presumably, in most cases, the commission will learn of these allegations before there has even been an adjudication or dismissal of the charges.
Mm-hmm.
The commission can, in that case, I submit to you, did investigate the charges before there was even the question of the defendants becoming eligible for expungement. And in fact, that is how the matters can and should proceed in most cases. The commission does a prompt investigation. There is no issue of a sealed records for the commission to contend with. It's only if the commission, after learning of these allegations, sits on its hands and waits until the conclusion of the criminal process and then waits another 30, 60, maybe 90 days for the expungement process to go through before commencing its investigation, that it has any restriction on its access to those, to that information.
I wonder if Dave might be able to respond to that too, Mr. Chair.
Sure. Yep. We'll invite him back up here. Yep. For the record, I'm David Meinton, Executive Director of TSPC. Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, would you repeat the question, please?
I don't know if I remember it. Well, my question started off with, like,
I'm understanding the legal, I'm not understanding it, but I understand the legal interpretation of this whole thing, the problems of legal and so forth. I'm sitting here, as we often do, we put ourselves in our own role, and I'm back to running the school, and I'm saying, hey, from what I've heard and what's happening out there and so forth, even though there was a decision not to convict or prosecute and so forth, I don't want that person in my school. Is that what you're trying to get at? I mean, obviously that word is out among students. The effectiveness of that person is shot as a teacher. Parents are concerned. You just think of all the problems that go on out there. And you have someone that maybe a judge or maybe the DA just decided not to prosecute it for some reason. But I'm making an assumption that happened. And I know that's a... No, let's pretend you know what happened.
Mr. Chair.
What do you do in that case when you don't want that person back in your school?
Mr. Chair, Senator Duncan, in the example I gave, the educator admitted taking the student to his apartment.
Okay.
But in other cases that we've had, it may be based on a report from the school district about an incident. And with regard to a comment that Mr. Kaplan has made about proceeding with an investigation while the criminal process is underway, district attorneys ask us not to intervene or proceed with interviewing any of the witnesses or in any other way interfering with the district attorney's case until the matter has been adjudicated. So we often are constrained, at least by persuasion of the district attorneys, not to get into the cases until they're finished with them. In most cases, those records from the district attorneys are then turned over to us, and there is a requirement on those sex offenses that are listed in 342.143 that judges also report to the commission when a person's been convicted of one of those. But the kind of cases that we're proposing this change would benefit are cases where there has not been a conviction for one of the mandatory offenses.
Mr. Chair, just add one comment, English person again, and Senator Duncan. However, even in those cases which are being prosecuted and where the prosecutor requests that others not get involved during that time period, prior to getting an expungement of even an arrest, you have to wait 1 year. It's not something you can do immediately, and 3 years if you've been convicted of an offense. So there is certainly a significant time period for the commission or others to act in that period.
Yes, Senator.
I mean, you didn't. You're talking about yanking licenses here. Are you also talking about whether to grant a license? You've used these to make decisions on whether to grant a license?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, that statute applies both to issuing the initial license or renewing the license or initiating proceedings to withdraw a license that the educator already has and that has not expired.
So to follow up on the subject of granting a license, you wouldn't grant a license to somebody who was under indictment
for some time. Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, the Commission's administrative rules authorize me as Executive Director to deny a license or to deny renewal of a license if there's evidence that the person may lack fitness to serve as an educator. In that case, we send them a notice of opportunity for a hearing, and if the person requests the hearing and the license is up for renewal, the license remains in effect until a final order has been issued by the commission.
Is this most of the information that you find in the sealed records, wouldn't a good investigation uncover? Well, I mean, if you subpoenaed the right people and got to the bottom of it in another way, couldn't you get that information without going through this measure?
May I defer that question to Joe McKeever, please?
That's right. McKeever.
He needs to come up here.
So there is one issue we would have known as one of the chronicles that oftentimes there is a criminal proceeding pending. We do defer action until the police
finish their action and the prosecutor is completed. And frequently the district attorney requests us not to be involved with other criminal matters. These reports are important because when there's a criminal accusation, the police very, very often are the first people on the scene. And the evidence that they uncover is the precious evidence. It's often the most reliable. And so it's important for all of those reasons. Also, the reports themselves are important for the commission to conduct its own investigation. I mean, the suggestion has been that we're going to use these reports as some backhand way of putting the report into evidence and taking away somebody's license. We don't do that. That's not sufficient. The commission would need to conduct its own investigation, call its own witnesses in order to prove a case, which is important enough to revoke somebody's commission. So the focus of the suggestion that we're only going to use these reports against the individual, I think it's simply not the case. It's not the purpose of this job.
I asked Ingrid the question about what kind of crimes are we getting at. I mean, David might use the example of the student coming to the teacher's apartment. As I read it in terms of the language of the bill, all the sex abuse, child neglect, criminal mistreatment statutes are exempted, so they wouldn't apply here. So what kind of crimes are we getting at there? I'm looking for some relation to the teacher's ability to teach.
Chairman, Senator Brown, I'm glad you gave me a chance to respond to that. Because while it's true that the expungement statute with respect to the conviction involves somewhat minor offenses, misdemeanors and Class C felonies, it also deals with arrests. Those arrests can involve any type of crime, including very serious crimes, including crimes of rape, sex abuse, murder, you name it. Any arrest which does not result in conviction permits the professional, permits the criminal defendant immediately after an acquittal or the charges are dropped, not 1 year after. 1 year after if they charge but don't indict. But if there's been charges filed that are dropped or if there's been an acquittal, the criminal defendant can go in immediately thereafter and have all the records sealed. Mr. Kaplan's familiar with that because he's had two cases where that's exactly what's occurred, where there's been a teacher who was acquitted of, I believe, both of those sexual charges, and thereafter the teacher's counsel immediately had all records sealed, including all police reports. Now, one other thing with respect to, let's call the officers are witnesses. Under this bill, the officers themselves don't have access to their own reports. And I would guess that some of you may have had the experience of how difficult it would be for a police officer to testify several months after the fact if he doesn't have his reports there to refresh his or her recollection.
Can I kind of follow up? And so we're talking, it would include child abuse reporting cases, for example, even where there's a family divorcing and somebody makes a report in that case and there were no charges filed or there were charges filed and then dropped. It would include those types of cases.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, yes, it would. In those cases, those reports may often contain accurate information. I would certainly concede that. That's why we wouldn't rely on the reports alone.
So, Turner, as an initial screening process, you can access Lez, can't you? TSC can go into Lez and do a basic background check.
Mr. Senator Turner, yes, we can.
Good, thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. With that, we'll close then the public hearing on House Bill 2096 and open a public hearing on House Bill 358 and invite Kathy Osborne, Karen Gazelle, and Ingrid Swenson for it, please. Yeah, I'm getting a cold and losing my head. My fourth cold.
You're not
sick of taking it. Yeah, I took some. I need to take more.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, since Karen signed up in favor of the bill, and you we'll let Karen go first, and then crash it. Really means they oppose if they don't want to say
it. Actually, that's not usually a problem for these two, so.
Well, and I pointed out to Senator Courtney that both he and I are listed as sponsors on Senator Backlund's bill, so I don't know if that's possible as well. Karen.
Karen Bezos, Deputy Director of the Oregon Youth Authority, and I am here primarily in support of a two amendments, which I believe you have before you. The Youth Authority is certainly not opposed to providing the kind of information required in the bill of notice to youth schools when youth who are on parole or probation are enrolled in the school district. However, we're asking for some reciprocity, and I've talked to the School Board Association and of the bill, or at least his office, and what we're asking for is that then these same youth who are on parole or probation and are supposed to be attending school, the condition of their parole or probation and want to school, that the district notify the parole officer of their lack of attendance. And we're not asking that they do that in any particular form or format other than that which they would normally do to notify parents. So if they have a school policy that says after three unexcused absences, the parents get called, or if it's one, or whatever it is. We do have a number of cases where the youth, of course, reports to the parole officer that they have beautifully been attending school and they've not been in school.
Any questions for Karen? Catherine?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kathy Osborne from Juvenile Rights Project. I actually just have a technical problem that I just noticed. On House Bill 3158 is taking out subsection 4 of ORS 419A, 0.015. Senate Bill 449, which was passed by this committee and is actually over in the House right now, adds language to the same section which this bill would eliminate. So there's an obvious conflict there. In speaking with Oregon Youth Authority and Jim Green from the school board, we all prefer the language in 449.
We need a conflict amendment. That
you would need a conflict amendment on that.
Okay. We need a conflict amendment.
That was my comment as well.
All right. Thank you. When we get that conflict amendment, we'll bring it back to work session. Our final public hearing today is Senate Bill 65, Bill Linden and Kingsley Clay. This one will go down to Ways and Means, and no one should get excited about the new judgeships that are created in the first section. Basically, the Bleach report recommendations, is that correct? And that's the commission that makes recommendations to the legislature. Is this, is Section 1 significant for any other purpose?
Mr. Chairman, for your record, Bill Linden, representing the Oregon Judges Association. We are actually here today to urge you to adopt the Dash 3 amendments.
Which we don't have yet. Do you have them yet? Good. I was hoping for that.
This is
still go down the way here.
Mr. Chairman, I could try and very briefly explain the dash 3.
Why don't you do that?
First of all, the dash 3 is delete the new judgeship language. There are some other vehicles in ways and means in which new judgeships can be addressed, but Senate Bill 65 will no longer relate to new judges. What we have done in this bill is brought together a number of ideas that the state courts and the judge associations have in terms of a variety of court-related issues, and have put them together in somewhat of an omnibus bill that does need to go to the Ways and Means Committee, because a good number of the features of the Dash 3 amendments involve issues in which there would be some increased expenditures that the legislature had decided they wanted to cover. The first six sections has to do with collection of delinquent accounts in the state courts. This is very similar language to House Bill 3509, which has been considered by this committee. That related to executive agencies. This relates to courts. Sections 7 and 8 deal with a family law facilitation project that a number of courts have indicated an interest in. That would involve some funding. Sections 9 to 11 involve an innovative program that was proposed by the Judicial Department to set up a court productivity and access improvement fund in which good ideas would save money. There would be some way of rewarding courts that have accomplished things of that nature. Section 12 is relates to a clarification on the definition of what family court departments entail. Basically, it would bring in probate proceedings and any other proceeding in which a family is involved. The Section 13 and 14 would allow for the Chief Justice to expand the Family Court Advocate programs beyond Jackson and Deschutes County. There are other circuit courts and counties very interested in getting into that particular area. Sections 15 and 16 are somewhat technical amendments relating to returns on orders of assistance. Basically provides that law enforcement agencies to which an order of assistance is directed have to inform the court if the order in fact has been executed.
I'm just teasing. Representative Backlund, if you want to testify in the last bill, I'll be happy to reopen the hearing. We'll get the conflict amendment and pass it out. But if you want to testify, okay, we'll invite you back. Thank you. I apologize for the interruption.
Mr. Chairman, Section 17 makes some amendments to a law passed in 1997 that deals with local family law advisory committees. Again, these are family law-related activities going on within the court system, which more counties want to participate in. Sections 18 to 20 deal with electronic applications in the courts. You've seen this and several other features and different bills in front of the committee. Those bills, several of them have gone to the Ways and Means Committee. They have not prospered on their own down there. We're going to see if we can't get some interest in some of these ideas in this omnibus bill.
I understand so much. I'm going to come back. Just put it in front of
you. The Ways and Means process?
No. No, it's the Section 18 electronic part and so forth. It's just
the generational.
Yes. Not necessarily. You're getting there. Sections 21 to 23 make some fixes that are needed in terms of interpreters and juvenile proceedings. For one, they grant an opportunity for interpreters to be provided to persons of parties that have been granted rights of limited participation in juvenile proceedings. And also provide that in the juvenile arena, interpreters will be appointed as they are in other types of cases. Sections 24 to 27 change the name of the Supreme Court Library to the State of Oregon Law Library, which is, in essence, is what that library is. It's available to the public and to use, and it is probably the premier law library in the state. And that is all those sections do. Section 28 deals with court security. Back in the 91 session, I believe, a court security fund was created. This section would allow one court that had an excess of funds to transfer those funds once a year to another court that had some unmet needs, did not have enough funds. It will basically benefit smaller courts that can't generate the kind of funding that some of the larger courts can, and it's a provision that all the presiding judges have endorsed. Sections 29 to 23 relate to judicial compensation. You'll see that there are blanks in the bill. The Public Officials Compensation Commission in the interim studied compensation for elected officials, including judges, and made some recommendations to this assembly. We're not certain those recommendations will be acted upon, but we wanted to have an opportunity for this section to be addressed and reviewed by the Ways and Means Committee. Sections 34 to 39 deal with judge retirement. The judge retirement plan is very, very different than the PERS plan that you hear most talked about in terms of regular PERS. Judges have a defined contribution, defined benefit plan. They have a statutory cap on benefits. They do not, for example, have available to them the money match option. It's a very different plan. On the positive side, it recognizes that judges come into a public service later in life than many public employees, so they have higher accrual rates in the beginning parts of judge service. This would do three things. It would increase from 16 to 18 years the period of time in which judges accrue retirement benefits at the rate of 3.75% a year. Judges are elected for six-year terms. Your average career judge is going to serve at least three terms. That's 18 years, and that's the rationale there. It would also clarify that we have two types of retirement for judges. One is called Plan A, and it's just a straight retirement. When you're done, you're done. Plan B is the plan that was created by the legislature in 1991, under which judges receive slightly enhanced benefits if, in return, they provide 35 days of free service after retirement for 5 years. And this section, Section 36, will clarify that while they're actively providing that service, they remain eligible for health benefits. That's been unclear since the statute was originally adopted. It also makes it clear that during that period of time, they're not eligible for payments against the cost of Medicare supplemental insurance that are currently available under ORS Chapter 238. This is a fairly significant issue for judges who are continuing to serve in the Plan B capacity. Now, once they finish, they're finished with the health insurance as well.
So this would say under Plan B that the judge medical benefit plan would be paid by the state.
Until their active service requirement is completed.
But if they were 65 and qualified for Medicare, it would not cover them?
It would not. In other words, you don't get both. You don't get the coverage of the Plan B judge and the supplemental Medicare insurance coverage until you have completed your Plan B service requirement.
What's the situation now if you are a retired judge on Plan B? Do you pay for your own health insurance benefits?
That's correct, unless you're over 65, in which case you're receiving the supplement.
And how many judges do we have that are prior to their 65th birthday?
That's true. Let's click on that.
There's approximately 180 judges now
right. That
are full-time judges.
Right now there are 22 that would qualify under this section because they're actively serving their Plan B service. It only applies during that service period, that five-year period.
In terms of retirement, would you say that these couple of sections improve retirement plans for the judges?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, yes.
Okay.
The accrual rate, the 16 to 18 years, is definitely improving the retirement plan. The insurance coverage, while we're actively providing free pro tem service, in many ways is more of an the retirement benefits don't kick in. It's more of an inducement for people to go the Plan B route, which does gives the system, a lot of free and experienced judicial service.
Mr.
Chair.
Yeah.
Two questions. I'm sort of just looking at big picture stuff, and that is, my understanding is generally the judge's retirement is pretty good, and I understand that most of them come onto the bench in later years. And I guess my question would be, at a time when we're reducing employment benefits for public employees in general, what's the public policy decision behind improving benefits for judges?
Chairman, Senator Brown, the judge retirement plan is very, very different from the regular person's retirement, and it always has been. For example, in some of the bills you've seen in this committee, like Senate Bill 722, judges are not covered under the provisions of that plan. In attracting good, qualified people to the bench, it's a simple fact that most of them are going to take a cut in salary to become a judge. And therefore, they look at the total compensation package very carefully when making that decision. Our retirement plan in Oregon for judges, if you look at it, just simply stacked up against retirement plan for regular PRS members, you could say in some ways the judge's plan is better, in other ways it is not. When you look at it in comparison to what other states do, it's an average plan in terms of its benefit. We have a real need, given that our salaries rank in the low 40s among the 50 states for judicial officers, to make sure we've got that total compensation plan that makes it an attractive career for the qualified and competent and brightest lawyers to look at. We were not trying to make a commentary in terms of other legislation relating to PERS with this suggestion.
Mr. Chair, can I just follow up? The first two reasons you suggested were a cut in salary and then looking at the entire compensation package. How is that different than any other public employee?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, I don't know enough about the career point at which your average public employee enters service. I'm sure that there are cases in which the public service was.
It was really more of a rhetorical question.
Thank you.
I hate to pick on Bill because I know where he is on both sides of this issue. So
it's okay to pick on
you. Right here for.
Sure does.
He left public employment.
I know.
Happy first minister.
Like I said, I don't think he's hurting.
I sure. I don't think he's hurt much of that.
I don't have much of a retirement plan, though.
I don't need one.
You don't need one. What about
2-3? You have no choice. All you got to do is go sit on the beach for the rest of your life. You have no sweat.
So you wouldn't really have a question.
I didn't want to comment on Section 38.
I bet you did.
Why did you want to move on?
This section creates what I think, at least, is just sort of a historical anomaly. The Judge Retirement Fund covers about 180 people right now. It is managed separately as a fund from the regular PERS fund, which has 40,000 plus active members at least. Section 38 would merge those funds together. It doesn't have any effect on the benefits for judges. Those are set out in separate statutes, but it would manage the judge fund along with the regular PERS fund. And I think over time it would tend to bring down the cost of employer contributions in the judicial branch. Right now, I think judges, from coming by any amount, the only group of state officers or employees whose retirement contribution is actually being reduced. This will, I think, over time reduce it even further, and it doesn't make any sense to manage such a small fund statutorily separate from the larger fund. The last section of the retirement piece is a piece brought by the Senior Judges Association that would provide a one-time benefit increase for a small number of judges who are not Plan B judges, who retired before Plan B became an option for the state. For example, it would provide a retirement before January 1, 1981 would result in a 15% increase in benefits. This would address an issue that's been longstanding with the senior judges about retirement levels that haven't kept up with cost of living over the last couple of decades. It's about a $200,000 funding issue, whether Ways and Means can find money for it is very uncertain, but we'd like to get that piece as well down there for them to consider.
Has this been offered before?
This has been offered before, Senator.
Rang a bell.
Yes. It's usually been offered on its own. We're putting it together with this package again to see. My expectation is that the bill is sent to the Ways and Means Committee. They will look at all the various pieces of it and decide if there are any of them that they wish to fund. There are some things in this bill that don't require funding, and they may be the only things that come out of that process, but we'd like to have an opportunity to make our arguments down there on some of these other issues.
And we could go back and pick up people who retired from PRS just prior to 1990 for some special benefits to the retiree. And I just talked about people in
my
no,
what year did you want?
What year did you want?
93.
93 is what I meant.
This relating clause is a little too narrow to do that, but
really.
Section 40 of the bill repeals the 1987 law that required the courts to collect and report data on tort cases. It was part of the tort reform discussion of the late 80s. Ms. Click can correct me if I'm wrong. I know that during my tenure as state court administrator, I never had one single request for the report. And I don't know if the public enthusiasm for reviewing it has increased at all since 1995.
For the record, King's Click, State Court Administrator. I forgot to identify myself earlier. So. Mr. Chair, Mr. Lynn is correct. It continues to be a non-seller. Mainly, the biggest problems are when it was passed, was one, a resource issue for pulling together reporting information, but there really wasn't any practical means of enforcement provided because all the requirements are on the attorneys to report this information to the court. So several attempts have been made since 87. We did publish an initial report in 89, and that was pretty bad. And since then, it's gone downhill as far as being able to produce any kind of usable data with any statistical meaning. So it's something that, if it's a need in the future, could be developed, but probably developed in a way that might work better. So in the spirit of having been asked to repeal legislation that requires unnecessary, redundant, or obsolete requirements upon the court, we submitted this one.
Section 41 is a technical fix that would clarify that judges are not disqualified by the virtue of the fact that a judge is serving as personal representative. That's been in law for years, and nobody quite sure figure out why. Section 42 just makes a technical change in terms of it changes the word defendant to judgment debtor in a claim statute. Court security, section 43 through 46. This is, in essence, Senate Bill 59, which you've looked at, and it deals with firearms and dangerous weapons in courthouses. This is the version that does not include the amendments relating to funds. I'm not sure if that might move on its own, but this one is simply dealing with the courthouse issue and does provide that the presiding judge of the judicial district under this statute can enter an order that does permit the possession of specific weapons in the court facility. So where it's appropriate, a presiding judge has the authority to do that. And then sections 46 and 48 are just miscellaneous provisions and also an emergency clause in section 48. So I'd be happy to try and respond to any questions that you might have.
It's interesting to alert my committee was there's a section dealing with legislative salary, and it deletes the old requirement that it was 17% of the salary of the district court judge.
Mr. Chairman, that is my omission. We have, at least for the sixth session in a row, submitted the disconnect language on judge and legislative salaries. That was adopted in 1983. Any time there's been an adjustment in judicial salaries since then, I believe there's been a notwithstanding clause on that particular provision. This is just our seventh attempt to suggest that maybe a disconnect would be appropriate.
They don't want to decide that. What is salary range one in the management service compensation plan?
Mr. Chairman, I believe it's what legislators currently receive as compensation.
So we are.
You're doing better off with them than you would be with 17% of a circuit court judge.
We're in the lowest salary of the management service compensation plan.
That's right, known as the bottom of the totem pole.
Yes. Question. Kingsley, do you have anything you wanted to add?
Mr. Chair, no. It was just primarily to respond to questions on A sections.
Committee, I'll give you a couple days to read through this, and I mentioned to Senator Kim that we'd be sending him something. He said what, and I said, I don't know yet. I haven't read it. So if you want to have a conversation with me before I send it down there, I'll do that. We'll set this for you.
Just a comment, I was certainly asking Bill some difficult questions, but the reality is I realize our judges are not the best paid in the nation, but they do make a decent living. And this is sort of looking at the big picture. It just seems absurd to me that we would be reducing employment retirement benefits for public employees, with the exception of judges, and improving their retirement. I'm not saying they don't work hard. I'm not saying they don't make sacrifices, but it just seems to be weird to me that we would do that. Just a comment, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And that will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 65. We have three brief things to handle, all for work session. The sheriff first would move for possible reconsideration, and like to suspend the rule, which we send House Bill 3586 to the floor without objection. So ordered. The chair would then ask that we reconsider the vote, at which we send 3586 to the floor. Session, objection, being in order. House Bill 3586 is now before us. And in your packet, you'll see some amendments that look very familiar to some Senate Bill 59. Here's what the chair would like to do. And I'd like to stuff this into 3586. And the reason for doing that is it's late in the session, and I'm not sure what the fate of Senate Bill 59 would be. I still intend to make one change to Senate Bill 59 and send it to the floor for a vote. But it's going to be a close vote, and I didn't want to jeopardize the courthouse facility portion of it, which I don't think is controversial. So that was my idea. I noticed in Senate Bill 65, they also tried to do what you're accomplishing with this amendment, although I think this does a better job of it. But that's my purpose in raising this.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, if I just comment, I think the judges have been very good-spirited about having this issue in their bill, and I certainly think this is a good addition to the
Thank you. I appreciate the cooperation. So, Mr. Taylor, I think I would still prefer to do it in the Dash A4 rather than put it in the Senate Bill 65, because 65 is going to have a tough battle also.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I didn't have a chance to fully read 65 because we just got it beforehand, but I think I agree. This does it a lot better. The problem here is that current law says that you can't take a dangerous weapon into a courtroom in addition to a deadly weapon, which would be a firearm. Unfortunately, a dangerous weapon is defined after the fact. So some district attorneys are reluctant to prosecute someone for carrying a drug, a dagger in the courtroom. What this would do is list those weapons that are not allowed in the courtroom. So nonetheless, it would be providing judges the option of allowing certain people to carry firearms.
And I'm happy to report, since we've increased the security in courthouses and banned the carrying of weapons, there haven't been any more deaths. If you recall, for a while there, we had both attorneys and plaintiffs and defendants being shot, and that has not happened. So that turns to the words. Well, with that, the chair then would move the dash 84 amendments to House Bill 3586. Discussion? Objection. So ordered. The chair then would move 3586. The floor be passed. Discussion? Objection. If it passes, I'll go ahead and carry that. We'll now then go into work session on House Bill 3808 and Senator Brown. This is...
This is my baby, so to speak. You should have, this bill is, you recall, created the crime of female genital mutilation, which the House made a Class A misdemeanor. It also provided for an educational program in communities that traditionally practice this. I talked with Joanne Bauman. She is opposed to anything higher than a Class A misdemeanor. But that's more on her, was more on her general philosophy of other crimes that were out there. Julie Gianella, who's the chief sponsor of this bill, is not opposed. We have two amendments before us that would raise it from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class B felony or a Class A felony. I'm not finding either one, but it makes sense to me to raise it to a Class B felony.
And if you recall, this is currently probably a Measure 11 offense. It very likely could be, so to reduce it, it would require 18 votes from the Senate.
It would be the dash A4 amendment. So, Mr. Chair, I would move the dash A4 amendment.
Thank you. Senator Brown moves to dash A4 amendments to House Bill 3608. Discussion? Objection? Order.
Mr. Chair, the other amendment is the dash A5 amendment, and it's my understanding that this charge means the child abuse reporting statutes.
I got it. There it delivered.
Okay.
A5.
Move the dash A5.
Senator Brown moves the dash A5 amendment to House Bill 3608. Discussion? Objection? Orders.
Mr. Chair, I would move the bill as amended to the floor and to the staff recommendation.
Senator Brown moves House Bill 3608 as amended to the floor and to the staff. Discussion? Objection? Supported. Senator Brown, would you carry it?
I sure will.
Thank you. Next, we have a session on House Bill 3591. Tim.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to submit it up to the staff recommendation.
Is this the one that we intended to make the amendments that Hale Penn requested?
Yes, Mr. Chairman of the Committee. We have two sets of amendments here.
Are those amendments ready?
Actually, they're supposed to be ready, but what we also have before you is the House Bill 2205, which we plan to amend. Into the bill, as you all have died on the Senate floor, and there was some confusion on the floor, and some amendments asked that the issue be brought back up.
Okay, yeah. Fine.
This is the one that the first vote with five members absent failed by one vote, and the second one with everyone present failed by two votes. So,
remember who you said are. Not get into the discussion about what happened on this week, Mr. Chair.
All right. So I think the first thing to do is to move the dash A5 amendment.
I move the dash A5 amendment to House Bill 3591.
Discussion? Objection? So ordered. That motion passes. Then I think the second motion is to move from House Bill 2305, Amy Gross, the lines beginning with in line 13 through 15. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Actually, I think it would be lines 4 through 15
to be
the whole thing. All right. So we have a little question.
Senator Courtney then moved that we adopt from the House being gross 2305, lines 4 through 16. Discussion. Objection.
Hold it. I'm
going to
object to those amendments.
Yeah,
I'm sure you are.
You want to object to the amendments or
the bill? I'll object to amendments. I like the bill.
Okay. Please record Senator Brown as objecting. Then Senator Courtney
moves 3591 as amended to the House Bill Pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Courtney moves House Bill 3591 on the floor to pass. Discussion. Objection. Please note Senator Brown is objecting.
I will be an objection. I'm feeling quite ornery in the bathroom.
I'll be an objection too.
Who is going to be in?
That's just fine.
Really now.
Two objecting.
It's time for me to change position, but I'm not going to.
Thank you. Got him hypnotism.
I may change my mind by the time it gets to the floor, because I think that the penalties for providing alcohol to minors should be improved. But
yeah, this is hard.
Turner, I suspect you don't want to carry
it. I'm not going to carry it. I'm curious.
I think it should be Senator Courtney, since he will change his vote.
Yes.
Senator Courtney will carry it. And,
we
are adjourned. We have just one interesting meeting next week. They are all difficult bills. And we're going to go all 5 days.
Yeah, and we're going to go in the evening, all 5 days. No.